Six Music.
Right now, Six Music documentary.
Hello, my name's Amanda Ghost. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I recently had the chance to visit Joni Mitchell at her home in Los Angeles. I first met Joni when we shared the same record company a few years ago, and I'm proud to call her a friend. She is the consummate artist. Very few people have had more influence on modern popular music than this woman. And the good news is that after announcing her retirement some years ago, she's proved herself wrong. At the age of 63, she's back in a really creative mood, exhibiting her art, working on a ballet, and releasing her first album of new songs for nearly 10 years. Tonight, you can hear our conversation and exclusive previews of tracks from Joni's new album for the first time on the radio anywhere in the world. So, welcome to Coming From The Cold, the return of Joni Mitchell.
Back in 1957, we had to dance a foot apart. And they hawked us from the sidelines, holding their rulers without a heart. And so with just a touch of our fingers, all we could make our circuit be explode. All we ever wanted was just to come in from the cold.
Hi, I'm Joni Mitchell.
Hello.
We know each other.
We do.
What's that mean?
Joan, we've known each other for a long time. We have a bizarre connection as artists, I think, and songwriters, in the sense that I was signed by an A&R man called Andrew Wickham at Warner Brothers, and you were signed by him too. I think, in fact, you were his first ever signing at Warner Brothers.
Well, I wasn't aware of that, but apparently, as the story goes, I'm his first signing, she's his last. So
his last.
What happened in the middle is what I want to know. But we're the bookends of Wickham's collection.
Exactly. I mean, he says that he was in a house in Laurel Canyon. He had been in Los Angeles for a week. He'd had his job at Warner Brothers for 1 week. And he'd heard a song by Tom Rush called The Circle Game, which he was absolutely blown away by. And he wasn't aware that Tom Rush hadn't written that song. And he researched it and went to see who wrote it, and that the credit was Jay Mitchell.
And the seasons, they go around and round. Painted ponies go up and down. We're kept on the carousel. Can't return, we can only look behind from where we came and go round and round in the circle again.
And he told me that he then called Tom Rush personally and said, who is this Jay Mitchell? You know, this song's absolutely incredible. And he said, oh, she's this young singer that lives in Canada. Was that correct? Were you living in Canada at that time?
Detroit.
Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. I got that wrong. Anyway, he was very, very anxious to make contact with you. So he told me that he wrote you a letter saying, hello, you know, my name is Andrew Wickham. I live in California. It's very hip here. People are surfing. The music's great. You should think about coming out here. And apparently you wrote back this incredible letter. I think he said it was on lavender notepaper. It was maybe perfumed.
I did answer everything at that time. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. I answered every letter that I got. Now look at my kitchen table.
It's full of them.
It's drowning in mail from a year ago.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, he said you responded, and I think you had a few exchanges via letters, which probably seems completely alien to the people today in this email world. But anyway, you took the time to respond to him. And then he said you sent him some music. I think you said you'd done some recordings. I think it was maybe something you'd done live. And he said he received these recordings when he was at Warner Brothers. You sent him this massive reel of tape.
Yeah, well, that's all it was.
Right, yeah.
Reel to reel.
What year was this? Do you remember?
Be 66 or 7.
Okay, right. And I remember saying to him, so what did you think? What did you think? You know, what, did it just blow you away? Was it just absolutely amazing? And he said, well, I thought it was right.
Woke up, it was a Chelsea morning, and the first thing that
a song outside my window, and the traffic wrote the words. It came a-ringing out like Christmas bells, and wrapping up like pipes and drums. Oh, won't you stay? We'll put on the day, and we'll wear it till the night comes. Woke up in the Chelsea morning, to Rebecca. Oh, on this day, the full holiday, there's a sun show every second. Now the curtain opens on the morning of the day, and the streets are paved with passers-by. Pigeons fly and papers lie, waiting to blow. It was a Chelsea morning, and the first thing that I knew, there was milk and toast and honey, and a bowl of oranges too, and the sun poured in like butterscotch and stuck to all my senses. Oh, won't you stay? We'll put on a day, and we'll talk in present tense. Closes and the rainbow runs away, I will bring you incense owls by night, by candlelight, by jewel light, if only you will stay. Pretty baby, won't you wake up? It's a Chelsea morning.
He said, you know, what I loved about what I heard is that it wasn't political. And at the time...
It was love songs. I do remember that much, that there was...
Right.
Yeah, and it was kind of the vogue to be... But the politics were silly of my generation at that time. The protest songs, Blame the Soldier, they were impotent. You know, they weren't effective. They were adolescent. You know, Woody Guthrie was effective.
Right.
He had a way of doing it, you know, that was touching and therefore useful. But the artists of my generation were writing articulate songs, but that were ineffective, and they were insulting to the soldiers who were drafted, after all, into that war. You know, some of them were gung-ho, but even the gung-ho ones came back disillusioned. So while my generation and, you know, yes, in the folk movement at that time, which I was just passing through, because to me, that was beginner music. You know, it wasn't that I loved folk music so much. It sounded kind of fresh after rock and roll, because rock and roll was great when it started, and then it got kind of watered down in the second generation, and folk music rose up at that time on the college campuses, and it was participatory. So it was fun, so I picked up the guitar to play and basically to accompany bawdy drinking songs at Wiener Roasts. That was the most of my ambition. And then I discovered that I had a fairly decent voice, and I learned it very quickly. And so I appeared on the scene. I looked like a folk singer, and I started singing folk songs because they were easy.
There's a man who's been out sailing in a decade full of dreams. And he takes her to a schooner, and he treats her like a queen. There are beads from California with their amber stones and green. He has called her from the harbor, he has kissed her with his freedom, he has heard her off to starboard in the breaking and the breathing of the water wheels. And she's so busy being free.
You know, my heroes, of course, were Billie Holiday, and I hadn't lived enough life for you know, I'm a good mimic, but I wouldn't want to start off mimicking Billie Holiday. That's kind of sacred. You know, I never wanted to be a copycat. You know what I mean? So you have to wait. So I emerged on the scene as a folk singer, but I dressed all wrong. I dressed all wrong for art school, too. There were all these cliques, and they all had their uniforms and their rules and their laws. And, you know, like, and to belong to that club, you had to dress accordingly, talk accordingly, and behave accordingly.
So what happened? When you came from Canada, you went to Detroit, and then...
Right.
And then, so this guy writes you letters saying, come to California, I love your music. And then they offered you a record contract? Is that what happened? I mean...
Well, let's see. You know, in Detroit, I made a bad marriage. And within inside of that marriage, I was in a singing duo, which was really not musically compatible. I turned it as much as possible into comedy. I played kazoo. I stuck a pillow under my dress. I you know, in order to save face, I basically hammed it up on stage. My lead sheets were done by a black jazz group there, and they began to play my music, which was very melodic, in the jazz set. So in this club we played, like, you know, the musics were apartheid back then. Rock and roll should have been dance music, but suddenly, you know, you would go and sit still and look at it, and I could never understand why. You know, why would you sit still and look at it? It's dance music. But it went on at 7:30 and got off at 10:30. Folk music went on between 7 and 8, stayed till midnight, and then it was jazz after hours. So that was the compartmentalizing in the 60s of the musics. So anyway, we played at this little club, Chuck Mitchell and I, called the Chessmate, and it would go jazz after hours. And as they began to put my music into the jazz set, the audience would kind of go black in the last set. And there it would come in to see this person, you know, who wrote these melodies that were being played in the jazz set, and they'd get a girl with a kazoo, with false eyelashes, like bouncing around on stage, you know, just trying to make comedy out of a bad situation. And they were very tolerant of that, I must say. Just see these big bands of white teeth out in the audience.
So you were like this kind of bizarre apparition to them.
Yeah, I was. I wandered once accidentally in Florida. You know, I got mad at my husband in Coral Gables and thought I'd walk home to Coconut Grove, and there was a black neighborhood in between. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, in this gold dress that I made myself and gold stockings, I wandered into a black neighborhood, and it was a hot night, and there were a lot of people on the porches, and I heard this man say, "Just let it go by, just let it go by." So, you know, so in a way, I mean, I didn't fit into the folk thing because I was just passing through, but
these folk singers took songs that you wrote and covered them.
Sunny day, looking for
just to underline the point about Joni Mitchell's songs getting covered before we really knew who she was, that's Fairport Convention's version of I Don't Know Where I Stand. On their self-titled debut album in 1968, Joni didn't release her version until it appeared on the Clouds album the following year.
All alone in Carolina.
I'm Amanda Ghost, and this is my conversation with Joni Mitchell about her life and times. As a singer-songwriter, Joni Mitchell is such a huge inspiration for me. I had to ask her what were her early inspirations.
When I got into this bad marriage, we lived in a black neighborhood with a toddler house at the corner because it was low rent. The inner city was nearly all black.
Wow.
I began to write. When I began to write, my music came out kind of semi-classical because what I really loved was Tchaikovsky and Chopin and Rachmaninoff. The piece of music that made me want to be a musician was Variations on a Theme by Paganini. being a lover of nocturnes in particular, not so much symphonies because they're all in the same key, they're too predictable. The nocturnes or the rhapsodies, that kind of classical music, Debussy in particular. I grew up, my mother had three records, Clair de Lune, they were all moonlit, Moonlight Sonata, and my father had a little Harry James and some Leroy Anderson, he was a trumpet teacher. So I grew up loving horns, especially muted trumpets, and these melodic melodies, and that is still the essence of my sound, I think, through all of its incarnations.
Definitely. You know, I mean, you can hear it on this record.
Well, this one, it's really, because now, like, I can play the saxophones myself, which is a bit embarrassing. I feel, like, kind of proud of myself and kind of embarrassed because of playing with Wayne Shorter for so long, who's a genius horn player. So I'm playing, but I can see in my style as a horn player now that I'm very influenced by Wayne, but then Wayne is a descant singer. The thing that I love about his playing above all other horn players is the way he hovercrafts through my music. Descant, like melodic seventh drops and ninth drops and fifth and then a triad. And it, just the way he crawls across it.
Sees her turn and walk away, skittering like a cat on string. Her high heels clicking, what a wary little stray. She leaves him by the Seine alone, with the black water and the amber lights, and a bony bridge between left. That an English sailor, please have this little bit of instant bliss.
But in the beginning, it was just the guitar, wasn't it, with you?
When you got to start someplace.
Yeah.
It was the guitar and the piano.
Guitar and the piano.
Yeah.
And so how did these people hear your songs before you got signed? I don't understand that. I mean,
well,
they just came to your shows and they heard you playing and they thought, I want to cover that song. I mean, how did it work? Because you didn't actually write for anybody, did you?
Well, we lived in this apartment that in its heyday had been a ritzy place. It had bell holes in the floor for ringing for the servants. And we had three bedrooms, but it was in a poor black neighborhood in Detroit. So Eric Anderson, Tom Rush, different musicians passing through, Patrick Sky, Rambling Jack Elliott, they stayed with us. You know, we billeted them because none of us made any money to speak of. So you're always looking for somebody who would put you up. So every time Tom would come, and I was just beginning to write, because I was in a bad marriage, I would go down to the Toddle House at night, sit there and drink coffee and write songs. And it was a form of exorcism also, you know, Little Green. And, you know, I was trying to get a lot of my pain up.
I wanted to ask you, when you started writing songs, did you think you had a talent for it? Did you think, I'm actually quite good at this?
Well, there was always an excitement that you gave birth to it, but I was married to a man who had a degree in literature, who knew I'd never read anything and basically thought I was stupid. And like when I wrote Both Sides Now, he liked the package. He married the package, and then he thought he'd Svengali a brain into it, kind of. You know, so he married what he was pretty certain was a dumb blonde. I remember when I wrote Both Sides Now, he kind of ridiculed for me. He said, "Oh, what do you know about life? I've looked at life from both sides. Now you're only 21." You know, well, I had lived quite a bit of life. I'd survived quite a few diseases, and you know, and then the worst thing that could befall a woman at that time was to have a child out of wedlock, and I'd gone through that and the accompanying prejudice and terror, and I'd been tortured in the hospital. By the time I was 21, I had experienced a lot of life, a lot of the joy. I had a terrific teenage years, you know, like not like Janis or somebody. I didn't come to rock and roll to try and be popular. I was always, you know, I lost my athletic ability at 9 and went from being first and second chosen for teams to being not chosen at all. So I had a social crisis in my early years, but that made me have an inner life and made an artist out of me, I guess. That's where I forged my identity. I always thought of myself as an artist. And you can ask kids all the way back to the first grade. Joan was always the artist, right? So that was my saving grace, that when my athletic prowess was taken away from me, which would have been in that community, there were no artists in that community to be popular. was to be a good athlete. That taken away probably was good in the nurturing of my gifts.
Rose and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that weep, but now they only block the sun.
When you started writing these songs and these guys, these old, you know, the boys would come along and listen to what you were doing and say, I really love that, I want to do it, and you were, I mean, is that how it worked?
Well, Tom would come and stay with us, and he was always looking for material because he didn't write his own, and I would play things that I thought he would like, and he'd say anything else, and I guess I obviously, the ones that I withheld from him was not, I just didn't think they were very good. One was The Circle Game, and one was Both Sides Now. And, well, Both Sides Now, for instance, is a big meditation on fantasy and reality. Each verse is like half of it is young thinking and then an experience. It's like Blake, you know, in a sense, an experience kind of. I didn't think it was very successful. I thought I just skimmed the surface of it, you know, that I hadn't really gotten down to the meat of the situation. However, you know, people have found profundity in it over the years. When they hear the stories associated with it in people's lives, one guy used it, he sat his parents down, played it for them, and then told them that he was gay, you know, like, but he used it as an icebreaker. The place where I take pride in my songs is their utility. Are they good kids? Do they go out into the world and make nicey-nicey? You know, like, you know, can they hold a job out there? You know, like, can they survive? You know, I don't want to make castaway songs. Even though we're encouraged to make throwaway songs, it's a disposable culture, I still see that the song should endure. You know, and I mean, some things date, like a helicopter lands on the Pan Am roof, like a dragonfly on a tomb.
Helicopter lands on the Pan Am roof like a dragonfly on a tomb, and businessmen in button downs press into conference rooms.
In your own time, you see things become historical, or the price of the admission to the Tree Museum in Big Yellow Taxi. I finally just, you know, got rid of the price tag, because every time I sang it, I had to keep upping it, you know? So it's like they charged all the people an arm and a leg just to see them.
They paid paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Put them in a tree museum, and they charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Spots on apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. We pay paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? We pay paradise, put up a parking lot. We pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
But you see little bits of your work turning into Chaucer.
It's important, isn't it, as well, because we were talking earlier about you being viewed as a poet as opposed to being viewed as a lyricist, and what the difference is. It doesn't seem to me that many people accept you as being both.
Apparently I'm not a poet,
right?
You know, and in a way that's a good thing, because I don't like poetry for the most part. I'm with Nietzsche. They muddy their waters that they might appear deep. You know, I don't want to play the poet. I don't want to be the poet. I find it a lot of nauseating ho-hum, you know, wordplay, and not much meat on it. You know, I'm there with Nietzsche. I've looked among them for an honest man, and all I've dredged up are old gods' heads, old gods' heads. But perversely, like, there are a lot of people, like Dylan is considered a poet, Jim Morrison is considered, I'm not considered a poet. And basically, I guess I'm a frustrated filmmaker. And my favorite compliments, like, have come always from the black community, that it just seems this girl came up to me in the green room. She was a black girl working on the makeup department when you're at the Grammys. She burst into the green room, which was really uptight. It was all the rappers on, you know, one side. It was really apartheid in there. And she came bursting through the doors and she said to me, "Girl, you make me see pictures in my head." And I thought, okay, you know. Well,
biggest compliment.
Yeah, so I'm a frustrated filmmaker. So I'm making, if I can make people see pictures in their head, to me that's better than poetry. And in the song, you don't have the luxury that poets have. If you put anything in there too vague, in my opinion, at least the way I write, that makes them have to slow down and think, then they'll miss the next line.
Help me, I think I'm falling in love again. When I get that crazy feeling, I know I'm in trouble again. I'm in trouble, 'cause you're a rambler and a gambler and a sweet talking ladies' man.
Sit down and write a song. I mean, I know not every song is the same, and you know that not everything has the same process. But when you write a song, do you write the lyrics first? Does the music come to you, then the lyrics come? How does it work?
I seldom write the lyrics first, you know, because I find then I end up in iambic pentameter. You know, and it all goes white bread. So by creating the music first, the music then provides your rhyme scheme, and everyone is different. So you end up with harder puzzles, which I like. You know, it's harder to write it, to set the words to music, than it is to go the other way.
I always find as well, if you take a poem and someone says put it to music, it won't work. It won't work the same way.
It's easy that way.
It's easy that way.
I mean, that's
way.
What Schubert said. Oh, you know, Schubert did that. He said, they write themselves, because your rhyme scheme is given to you. It's easy to write the music when your rhyme scheme is given, but going the other way is harder and more challenging. And also, there's another level of challenge then in the writing, is to put the important thought on the apex of your music. You know, like, so you're working to that. Okay, here you don't have a lot of modulation, so there's more room for descriptive passages. Here, it has to be really direct communication because you're dealing with short phrases. So it's very challenging, but also, because it's hard, at least I have a structure to begin with. It helps to reel me in and focus me, and I like hard puzzles.
Pulled up behind a Cadillac. We were waiting for the light. I took a look at his license plate. It said, just...
I keep going back to the beginning, but it's just because I don't know much about it, and I'm probably acting quite ignorant, but I want to assume that everybody out there is just as ignorant as me.
Everybody's ignorant. We're all ignorant. We're born in the cave of ignorance.
Yes. shed some light back on. So Tom Rush heard these songs, he covered them, and people had hits with your songs before you had hits as an artist yourself.
I had very few hits, actually, which is a blessing for in my case. The first hit was Tom Rush was singing Circle Game and Urge for Going, and George Hamilton IV heard Urge for Going and had a country hit with it. That was the first hit that I had. Then Judy Collins did Both Sides Now, and she covered some other songs as well, but she had a hit with Both Sides Now, and then a lot of people covered it after that.
Those and those of it. hair and ice cream castles in the air and feathered canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way.
You were, in the meantime, making records on your own as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the first one you made was with Crosby, David Crosby.
Yeah, Crosby. Well, because when Andy signed me, there was no excitement about signing me because they thought I was, the folk movement was over, and basically they viewed me as, you know, a second-rate Baez or Judy Collins. So nobody really wanted me. Crosby and musicians saw my gift. But businessmen really didn't, because they don't know anything about music, A, and B, you know, they're so superficial, and also the whole business is so superficial. So she looks like a folk singer, she's a folk singer, right? You know, that was out of style. So Crosby loved the music and was a folk rock, which was the next wave, star. So he conspired. He said, I'm going to pretend to produce you because they're going to think I'm going to turn you into folk rock, but you can't make folk rock out of this. You couldn't. It was too semi-classical. It was like Schubert, you know. So he saw that. And so he went in and basically was a cheerleader, but that was about it, you know.
And he didn't really...
And sometimes a detractor.
But he didn't really produce your first record. You kind of produced it yourself, right?
No, it produced itself. It existed. He saw it in a club. All we had to do is get the performance down, you know. And they tried to get me to lay the guitar down first and then sing to it, and I couldn't. I had been playing so long that it was so interconnected. So all you had to do is get a good performance. So I thought, well, I know when it's a good performance, I can select that. So from then on in, I produced myself.
Light up, light up, light up your lazy blue eyes. Moon's up, night's up, taking the town by surprise. Nighttime, they left an hour ago.
Brings me to the record you're doing right now, which you're producing yourself.
Yeah.
And what number is this record in your career?
I think it's 23.
Wow.
Yeah. After a 10-year layoff, because I quit. I just got fed up and went, I've still got some time to develop my gift as a visual artist, you know, which I've kept going simultaneously all the way along, but never had total time to devote to it.
But you're a painter.
First, I'm a painter, yeah.
And just now you've just had an art show.
Yes.
In Los Angeles,
yeah.
which is not just painting, it's photographs and multimedia.
It's kind of state-of-the-art, it's mixed media, but it's taking a look at war. It's 60 big, 8 by, I don't know what the cross measurement, but vertical pieces, all on a war-related theme. World War I, World War II, a little bit of the French Revolution, Tiananmen Square, you know, a little bit of some revolutions, really, more than wars. I have a habit since early childhood of drawing kind of out into outer space and looking back at the planet, mentally speaking. It's not like nothing occult, like an out-of-body experience, but I just have a way of, I love nature. I can see the Earth without us as being better off. Maybe I'm a traitor to my species, I don't know, but I wish we weren't the way we were. You know, I wish we weren't so self-centered and fearful, because those two traits in us make us really dangerous to ourselves and to every other living creature.
And you're exploring these themes in your new record too,
yeah,
as well as in your art show.
I am, as nicely as I can put it. You know, I apologize for doing this batch. I'm trying to get some light ones going now, and I try to slip in some levity. And usually when I write heavy topics, I make the music intentionally very light so it doesn't go into melodrama, you know. But here I'm indulging in drama, like I'm actually playing heavy topics in the minor key. So, you know, it's kind of, to me, these are like showtime for the stupid human being, you know. Like, if he doesn't get his act together now, we've had it. We need a spirit of cooperation and generosity that basically we're incapable of for any... except for moments, you know.
Oh, let your little light shine. Let your little light shine. Shine on Vegas and Wall Street. Place your bets. Shine on all the fishermen with nothing in their nets.
You played me an absolutely brilliant song just now called Bad Dreams Are Good.
Bad Dreams Are Good.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, when my grandson was 3 years old, we went to a musical, and he was so good. And everybody said, how old is he? With three. He's so well behaved. I could never take my three-year-old to a musical. And afterwards, though, he got cranky and hungry. We were in a cafe, and he threw a big hissy fit, and we just got him all quieted down. And his mother was talking about his father and speaking ill of him, and I told her, you know, don't do that in front of the son. I'd even demo it. I'd like mock bad rapped her father in front of her, and she went, oh, and I went, see, aha, you know, it makes you feel bad if I knock your father. I said, I didn't really mean that, but just to show you. But anyway, she was doing that in front of him, and I thought, you're gonna give him a chip, you know. So at the end of it, she concluded her paragraph by, it's a wonder it doesn't give me bad dreams. And Marlon tugged on her sleeve, but mama, and so I said, what, Marlon? He said, but bad dreams are good in the great plan. I said, how do you know that? It took me like, you know, I didn't really know that till I was in my 40s. It's something you learn when you got a life tailing out behind you, you know. Really made me believe in reincarnation, because, and his eyes went dink, dink, left to right, you know, like he didn't really know how he knew that. He couldn't explain it, but he said it adamantly, you know. He's 13 now. The line just was one of the great quotes that I heard from anything in the English language, you know. So I called him up and I said, I'm going to use that line of yours in a song, you know. Like I'll set aside a little, I'm going to cut you in on the song a little bit for because you got the title line, you know.
So there's a couple of little tasters of tracks from Joni Mitchell's next album. Bad Dreams Are Good, and before that, Shine. In fact, Shine is the working title for the album.
The last record you did before this was Travelogue.
Right. I was just a contract fulfiller. You know, like my writing dried up about 97. and the Taming the Tiger was the last one, and it was pretty, I'm mad at show business, and a kind of a revisitation of love. And then they allowed me to do an album of covers, which I was never able to do contractually, which I enjoyed because I was able to sing in that genre as a standard singer, which is a different type of singing, which I never had the ability to express contractually. There was a swell of feeling in it where we all took off that was very, very rare where pop meets classical musicians. And they all crowded into the playback booth like little kids, like, you know, like, it was really beautiful. I mean, and we got most of the same players on the second date. So as big a band as it was, it wasn't just a for-hire feeling at all. I mean, we all lifted up together.
Answer me, oh my love, just what sin have I been guilty of? Tell me how I came to lose your love. Please answer me, sweetheart. You were mine yesterday. I believe that love was here to stay. Won't you tell me how I've gone astray? Please answer me, my love. If you're happier without me, I'll try not to care. But if you still think about me, please listen to my prayer. You must know that I've been true. Won't you say that we can start anew? In my sorrow, now I turn to you. Please answer me, my love. Without me, I'll try not to care. But if you still think about me, please listen to my prayer. You must know that I've been true. Won't you say that we can start anew? My sorrow, now I turn to you. Please answer me, my love. Answer me, my love.
They were nice projects, but they basically, it was because I just didn't have anything more to say.
And you covered some of your old songs on that as well.
Travelogue is all old material, revisited.
You know. And what made you pick the songs that you picked? Were they your old favorites? Were they the ones that you felt were more resonant of that time?
I have no idea. I can't remember my thought processes at the time, and I'm sure if I was to do it again, I would do it differently. But some of them, because I thought that I wanted to hear my arrangements transcribed and kind of preserved in classical form so that they could be played that way.
Yesterday, a child came out to wonder, caught a dragonfly inside a jar. Fearful when the sky was full of thunder, and tearful at the falling of a star. And the seasons, they go round
rolling round, and the painted ponies go up and down. We're captive on the carousel of time. We can't return, we can only look behind from where we came, and go round and round and round in the circle.
Thank you.
6 Music.